This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to Navarra Live. My name is Aaron Mastani. This evening I have the immense pleasure of being joined by Mike Bancole. Welcome back to the B team. Mike, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm great. The B team are back in action. Always a good day when the B team are in action.
Coming up later tonight, Labour's Rachel Reeves cites the Thatcher government as inspiration for the next Labour one. We look at the latest line from the United States on Israel's war in Gaza, and Reform UK are upset at being called far right. Stay tuned for all of that. A first story. With a general election on the horizon, which looks set to be a bloodbath for the Conservatives, Tory infighting is continuing to tear the party apart. Rumours have been swirling of a plot to oust Rishi Sunak as leader. Right-wing Tories want Commons leader Penny Mordaunt to replace him as party leader, according to a Telegraph article this weekend. The factor supposedly motivating those rebels is the party's recent polling. Now, current polling puts the Tories in the dust on just under 24%. That's essentially where they were at the lowest point of the Liz Truss premiership, something Sunak was, of course, meant to rescue the party from. And remember, this comes after tax cuts that will mean tens of billions are being spent on reducing national insurance. Of course, that's going down from 12 to 8%. Labour, on the other hand, has hovered, as you can see, around the mid-40s for the last year. Meanwhile, the right-wing party Reform UK have gained since Sunak became PM and risen significantly since October. They're now polling at 12%, and of course, their recent by-election results broadly confirm that national trend. So the Tories aren't just watching their base disappear, they're also watching parts of it, in fact, a very big part of it, as well as former Tory MP Lee Anderson, swing to Reform UK, essentially Brexit Party 2.0. And that's going to hit some MPs harder than others, namely those that got elected in the post-Brexit elections of 2017 and particularly 2019. But if you're a right-wing Tory rebel, would Penny Mordaunt, a member of the moderate wing of the party, really be your first choice? That question has led to accusations that the Mordaunt story might be an attempt by Sunak to bolster his own position, a bit of 5D chess. The I newspaper has reported this today. Tory insiders have said that the plotting and double briefing may have originated from inside Number 10 or been authorised by figures working in Downing Street because they believe it is, quote, helpful to tarnish potential suitors for the top job while also boosting loyalty for the Prime Minister. An ally of Mordaunt told me that the briefings were an attempt to ruin her prospects once Sunak steps down as leader. I suspect it was partly behind this as people trying to make it difficult for her own future. It's interesting that Kemi Badenoch is quite so loud on this, the MP said. Kemi Badenoch has also been tipped as the party's next leader and would be genuinely popular among right-wing Tories. And LBC has a third theory on what's happening. The Mordaunt stories are being planted, apparently, to bait Tory moderates into triggering a leadership election with Badenoch or Suella Braverman set to replace Sunak. The plot thickens. Whatever the source of the story, this was Penny Mordaunt responding to journalists this morning.
You're supporting the Prime Minister?
I'm getting on with my job and I recommend it.
Do you think you will survive the next election?
I'm getting on my job. I recommend it. They're doing their job, Penny. Don't forget, of course, if you're a political journalist in Westminster, you think your job is to harass politicians. Jeremy Corbyn, case in point. Whether the Tories are coalescing around Mordaunt or Sunak is desperately counter-briefing from Number 10, or there's a plot to put a right-winger in place, the picture for the current leadership is grim. The BBC reports a darkening of the mood among Tory MPs following a series of political blunders. These include Lee Anderson's defection, as well as revelations about racist comments made by top Tory donor Frank Hester about Labour's Diane Abbott. Then, as I said, there was also the damp squib budget earlier this month that failed to make a dent in the polls. In fact, in some polls, they've gone backwards since then. Taken together, that may explain why Tory MPs have told GB News that at least 40 no-confidence letters have been submitted against Sunak. It only takes 53 to trigger a confidence vote. And it's not just Tory members of Parliament who are worried. Conservative Home is a Tory blog that has the ear of grassroots Conservatives. On Politics Live, its founder, Tim Montgomery, said this.
I think Rishi Sunak has to go as Prime Minister.
Before the general election?
Before the general election, because he just can't do politics. I think he's a good man, a family man, a decent man in public life for the right reasons. But again and again, I study politics, Joe, incredibly closely. I don't really know what he wants to be Prime Minister for, what his ambition is, what legislation he wants to pass. You know, the Tories have a majority of 60 still, I think, in Parliament. Not sure with all the by-elections exactly how much it is. We should be passing historic legislation on vocational education and housing, etc. And Parliament, as we learned last week, the hours actually is in debate are lower than they've ever been.
Right.
And we need to put, if we have any chance at the next election of minimising the scale of defeat, we need to go into the election with an agenda for the future of this country. So at the moment, I don't even know what that is.
Who should it be then? Who should take the Tories into the election?
Well, I don't know who that person should be, but I know at the moment the party's in free fall. You know, there were opinion polls recently that had us on 18%, and I think that can't go on.
There's a pattern here, isn't there? You know, repeatedly over the course of the last 14 years, Conservatives, whether that's party members, prominent activists like Mr. Montgomery, MPs, even Tory prime ministers, they're against so much stuff. But it's very unusual they're actually for something. We're seeing that pattern being repeated here. I have to say, the context for those words, I think, is sheer desperation. He has every right, I think, to point to a poll, putting the Tories on 18% and saying this is existential. We have to do something, anything. I mean, that's probably reasonable. It's very unusual for a party to be on 18%. Just crazy. 18%. Jeremy Corbyn got 32%, and apparently that was the end of the world. 18%. Just remarkable. Summing up the sense of despair in the Tory party, a senior Tory figure told the BBC this. I think the party has just about had it. There's a realisation. There's nothing good left. I try to be objective on the show, but let me be quite frank to whoever said that. There's been very little good about the Conservatives over the last 14 years. Despite this, Rishi Sunak is putting on a brave face. He said this on Monday.
I'm not interested in all Westminster politics. It doesn't matter. What matters is the future of our country. And that's what I'm squarely focused on. That's what I get up every morning working as hard as I can to deliver, whether it's cutting people's taxes, increasing the state pension, today increasing the number of apprenticeships and talking to small businesses. Those are the things that matter to people. And as we've seen over the last few weeks, our plan is working. Inflation is coming down. Wages are growing. The economy is back to growing again. And if we stick to this plan, I can deliver a brighter future for everyone in our country. That's what I'm doing.
A quick point of clarification, wages are not growing. Wages are again lagging behind inflation. I think that was last month. And that's partly why inflation is falling. Because rising real wages can, of course, feed into inflation. I mean, I don't think that's true, but that's the argument. And inflation is falling even more quickly because those wage demands have kind of relaxed. So, you know, Navarro fact check here, that's not quite true. However, behind the scenes, things appear much more chaotic. You wouldn't know from Mr. Sunak's Pat Sharp Child TV presenter demeanour. The Times reports that allies of Sunak say he would rather call a general election than face a leadership contest. And while the Prime Minister has officially ruled out an election on the 2nd of May and is reported to have ruled out a summer election too, he will be meeting the powerful 1922 Committee of Tories, that's backbench Tory MPs, tomorrow evening. Of course, it's a general election and not a leadership election that the country needs. Here's how one member of the public summed up the situation on Newsnight.
If you think about what's happened with the Westminster government over the last 13 years and the number of changes of leadership there have been and everything that the panel has said today about austerity and about low police numbers that this gentleman raised and the fact that the health service is on his knees and the fact that the public transport system doesn't work and the fact that we've got local authorities declaring bankruptcy, yeah, sure, let's have another leadership election. I think we need to look at this. If you look at their track record, it's not a leadership issue. Yeah. It's the whole party and they have to go.
I just hear this so much, Mike, again and again and again. And what's extraordinary, I don't know who that woman voted for in the last election. I mean, it doesn't sound like she voted Tory. But what I hear again and again and again from Tory voters in 2019 is these people generally hate the Tory party as much as anyone else. I keep on meeting Tory voters who hate the Tories more than I do. I try not to hate anybody, but you know what I mean. So my question for you, is this rock bottom for the Conservative Party, or can they go lower?
Over the past 5 years, since they won that general election in 2019, the one thing the Conservative Party has taught us is, if you think this is rock bottom, guess what? We can go lower. And I think we've seen, you know, from Boris Johnson's time in office to when he was kind of almost ousted out of office, we didn't have Liz Truss, who lasts as long as the Cadbury Sun. We fast forward to Rishi Sunak, who apparently is going to save the day. And the polling numbers look just as bad as they were back then. So really and truly, what we've seen for the past 5 years since the general election is the Conservatives gradually erode public trust, you know, erode each other's trust. You know, we've seen infighting all the time. Yes, let's have another leadership contest. That's just what we need. It's just what the country needs. So I think we think this is rock bottom. It could be rock bottom, but things could get worse. And I look at the kind of the May local elections that are on the horizon. That could be a messy period for the Conservative Party in terms of how those go. So I think whenever you think they've hit rock bottom, they can go worse. And I just think, you think of all the things that have happened in the last 5 years, from Partygate, you know, Liz Truss again in office, and even this last week, we've had their largest donor, you know, essentially comments that he made about Diane Abbott, this horrific comments made about Diane Abbott come to the surface. We've had Lee Anderson, a very vocal backbench MP, become a Reform UK MP. This is a party in complete disarray. And I think that lady on Newsnight sums it up so perfectly. This isn't the idea of let's just change leader and let's get Penny Mordaunt in, let's get Kemi Badenoch in. It's gone beyond that. For the public has lost complete trust in the Conservative Party. And the party know that probably the person who comes in at best is a damage limitation job, right? That person cannot win the election for the Conservatives. I think most sensible Conservative MPs know that they cannot win that election unless some kind of miracle happens between now and the kind of date in October. The economy all of a sudden blooms and grows and wages grow and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, poverty is dealt with better. All of these big issues that we know the Conservatives don't deal with well at all. So I think they've hit rock bottom. Things will get worse because the Conservatives have shown us over the past 5 years that whenever they've hit rock bottom, things get even worse and they hit a new rock bottom.
I think that's right. I mean, I'm just writing this down. Since 2016, if they were to get a new PM, that would be their fifth PM. I mean, am I missing somebody? Cameron, May, Boris Johnson, Truss, Sunak, somebody else.
That'd be five.
So Truss, Sunak, somebody else. So that's five, but they would be looking at their sixth. They would be looking at their sixth Prime Minister since 2016. I mean, it's six. We're looking at potentially six Prime Ministers in 8 years. That is just absolutely unprecedented. Without any, I mean, we're already in unprecedented territory. So I'm sorry to be repeating myself, but that is just absolutely unprecedented. I mean, six. I think there's been six Labour Prime Ministers ever. I could be wrong. Let's go through this. Six Tory Prime Ministers. This will be their sixth. Since 2016, and how many Labour Prime Ministers? Brown, Blair, Callaghan, Harold Wilson, Clement Attlee, Ramsay Mac. Am I wrong? I mean, people in the comments, correct me. That's the Labour ever have had six Prime Ministers. This would be the sixth Tory Prime Minister since, and people say, oh, that's because Labour is very successful. No, they're a very successful party. The Tories just happen to be the most successful party in Western Europe over the last 120 years or whatever. Unbelievable. Mike, on Sunak, getting away from the old historical analogies, I think you're right. I think the right time to replace Boris with somebody else, let's be honest, Boris would have done better than absolutely everybody who's replaced him since, but the right time to replace Boris with somebody who would have been, the right time to replace the PM and make that person competitive would have been after Boris. I think once you have Truss, it's kind of a poison chalice. Do you think that there will be an election in the autumn? Or, I mean, you're saying how useless all these people are. I think that's broadly correct. Will it last that long? I mean, will there be a move against him before then?
I think it's difficult to tell. I think the move has probably already started, and there are some dissenting voices and some people who are concerned. I mean, Tim Montgomery is a very vocal conservative voice, and the fact that he's gone on TV to say, look, we need to get this guy out of the office, that is, I mean, that's fairly significant. So I think there is the idea that people are moving against the Prime Minister. And in many ways, they remind me of Chelsea Football Club, you know, who, for our football fans who are tuning in, who often just replace their manager, right? We're just going to get rid of this manager. You know, things aren't working. And often what a manager does is, you know, the new manager comes in, there's a bit of a bounce, it goes well, then it doesn't go well. And I think we're at the point now, you can't just keep changing leaders. So I think there will be some dissenting voices. Of course there will be. But I think most people realise this is a damn limitation job. And I think what the Conservatives, what some might hope is, let's see if things can get slightly better under Sunak. The economy might grow slightly, the things might get slightly better. The May elections might not be as bad as we think they're going to be. All of these things, let's just see what happens and just expect to, you know, just try and hope for the best. I don't see how, given what's happened with the last two changes, Liz Truss was an absolute disaster and Sunak has not been much better. He's lasted longer, but he's not been much better. I don't see how anyone sensible in that party thinks someone else can just come in within a few months and make things better in terms of polling numbers, in terms of like anything in British society. So I think Sunak will just about hang on until October. He might crawl through till October and it might be more scandals. There will be more scandals. There will be more incidents. There might be some more MPs defecting or standing down ahead of the next general election. All of that will happen. I think he'll make it through. And I think, you know, most Conservatives realise that we can't have yet another leadership contest. We can't go through this again. Let's just hope for the best. We're going to lose this election anyway. It's over. Like, it's literally over. And I think most of them do realise that.
Yeah, it's kind of that Tucker Carlson meme, you know, it's over and he looks miserable. And then there's the other one of it. No, this is actually over now. And I feel like that's the stage we keep on getting to. It's over for the Tories. I think it's like, this time they really are over. I think for me, them being really, really over is the fact that Nigel Farage is going to be campaigning for reform at the general election. Of course, it's effectively his political party, but there were questions about whether or not he'd be metaphorically on the pitch. I think the fact he is, look, this might come back to haunt me, but it's not impossible that reform get a higher share of the vote than the Tories. With Farage there, it's not impossible. I'm not saying it's likely. I don't think it's probable, but it's not impossible. And there are also, and it's something you just said there, Mike, there are major incentives for Tory MPs now who know they're on their way out. They might have a majority of, say, 5,000, and they know there's going to be a Labour majority in their constituency of 25,000, if present polling is correct. There are major incentives for them to now defect to reform. Major incentives, because, hey, at least I'll not have to follow the Tory whip. I can have a little bit of a reputation afterwards. I might even be able to get a TV or a media gig. I might be able to grift over in the US. So there are huge incentives. I would be very surprised if you didn't have a significant number of MPs now defect to reform. I don't mean, you know, dozens, but, you know, two, three, maybe more. I think that's quite plausible. And I think you're right. That means holding on till October will be incredibly difficult. Next story. Labour's Rachel Reeves aims to become Britain's first female Chancellor of the Exchequer. So, in some ways, it's no surprise she's trying to channel Britain's first woman Prime Minister, the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher. Tonight, Reeves is giving a speech in the City of London, the annual Mays Lecture. It's regarded as the city's foremost event for the banking and finance sector. And in her speech, Reeves will say this: I remain an optimist about our ability to rise to the challenges we face if we can bring together public and private sectors in a national mission directed at restoring strong economic growth across Britain. When we speak of a decade of national renewal, this is what we mean. That is what we mean. As we did at the end of the 1970s, we stand at an inflection point. And as in earlier decades, the solution lies in wide-ranging supply-side reform to drive investment, remove the blockages constraining our productive economy, and fashion a new economic settlement drawing on evolutions in economic thought. A new chapter in Britain's economic history. And unlike the 1980s, growth in the years to come must be broad-based, inclusive, and resilient. It's so interesting when people talk about supply-side reforms, it basically means we're not going to spend any money. Heard a lot of that before 2010 too. What you heard there is Reeves essentially saying she wants an inclusive version of what happened after the 1970s. In other words, she wants to do what Margaret Thatcher did and go for growth, but this time make it broad-based. Here's how The Telegraph ran with that story. Britain faces 1979 moments, says Rachel Reeves. Labour shadow chancellor vows economic takeoff, similar to Thatcher years, with growth-led policies. Takeoff! You know, it's like one of those rockets at Cape Canaveral. Your astronauts are Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, the fuel being Starmer's haircut, stability, and the fact that Rachel Reeves used to work for the Bank of England. Only there's a problem with comparing this liftoff to the 1980s and the Thatcher legacy, because Rachel Reeves is actually repeating a bunch of factually inaccurate right-wing nonsense. Firstly, between 1979 and 1983, the first term of Margaret Thatcher in government, the economy didn't take off. We actually entered a recession. Out of the first seven quarters of the Thatcher premiership, the economy was shrinking for six of them. Between the third quarter of 1979 and the first quarter of 1981, the British economy actually shrank by 5.9%. Just crazy. Imagine a Labour opposition in 50 years' time praising the economic policies of the Tories in the 2020s. That's basically what this is, only worse. Kind of hard to make sense of it. Of course, this is part of a media and political psyop that has to maintain the charade that Thatcher saved Britain, because how else do you make sense of all that pain and division to make the country in the long term weaker, poorer, and more divided? Then there's the fact that annual growth across the 1980s averaged exactly the same as the 1970s and was actually lower than the average growth of the 1950s and the 1960s. Again, remember, this was during the historic dividend of North Sea oil. Norway did a hell of a lot more with their oil than we did. Fortunately, Owen Jones put this very succinctly on Twitter. Labour shadow ministers are now peddling lies about Thatcherism. Average growth in the 1980s was almost exactly the same as the benighted 1970s. It was just less evenly distributed and accompanied with mass unemployment and devastated communities which never recovered. The fact we think otherwise and that the 1980s were a wonderful time for UK growth is, as I've said, effectively because of a 40-year media psyop. I'm sure Rachel Reeves probably thinks that growth was higher in the 80s than the 50s and the 60s. And that makes sense when you consider who owns the print media in this country and who has increasingly owned it since the late 1960s. And that is, of course, billionaires like Rupert Murdoch, the Barclays brothers, and Lord Rothermere. And it's not just Rachel Reeves making this claim about the Thatcherite success story of the 1980s. Here was Labour MP Darren Jones speaking to Times Radio.
Both Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair delivered that decade of national renewal for our country in terms of economic growth and wealth creation. Clearly, I prefer the Tony Blair version to the Margaret Thatcher version, given that, you know, there were people that suffered as a consequence of Thatcher's approach. But the argument that we're making today is that we are at that point again where we have the opportunity to seize a decade of national renewal in our country.
I have to say, it's absolutely extraordinary that at the very moment public services are in freefall, they're collapsing, and Britain is incapable of building infrastructure from 5G to nuclear power and high-speed rail, the Labour Party, the guys who are meant to believe in the state, are praising Margaret Thatcher. So many of this country's problems start in the early 1980s, from failing to build enough new housing stock, to cheering on deindustrialisation, to building an economic model dependent on services in the southeast of England. So let's cheer on Maggie T. And I should say, just finally, that is overt praise for Margaret Thatcher. You know, Rachel Reeves, as we'll see in a moment, can maybe say there's a bit of plausible deniability. He's saying Margaret Thatcher was responsible for a decade of national renewal. As I showed you a moment ago, between 1979 and 1983, the economy contracted by 5.9%. Mike, why are Labour happy to participate in this inaccurate distortion of what happened in the 1980s?
I think this is partly because of where Labour position themselves and how Labour think they can win this election. And Labour essentially said, look, we need to make sure we look economically competent. That's the kind of one of their big things, competence. Let's look sensible. We're the adults, we're going to sort things out, all of that good stuff, right? And part of the way they think they can look economically competent is by kind of evoking and adopting quite conservative policies when it comes to the economy. Now, we've seen that in a range of economic issues and a range of ways in which we've spoken, but one of the problems with this, and it's something that Ash has spoken about a lot, is the idea that for so many years, Labour have constantly fought elections on the terms of the Conservatives. So the kind of the convention among some people is Labour and the left are bad for the economy. You know, the kind of the right who are more responsible are better. And Labour has somehow adopted that frame, which is really bizarre. So Labour have tried to shift now to the right, or try to. Let's be absolutely frank, they have shifted quite emphatically to the right under Starmer. And now adopting this idea of Thatcher led to a decade of renewal. It's absolutely bizarre. And I think Thatcher's become this figure who's just unequivocally lionized by everyone across the spectrum, unless you're probably on the left like we are, who don't. But people just see her as this, just she was amazing. She was an amazing politician. Her kind of legacy has grown its own legs, which is fascinating to see kind of in the last sort of 10 years. She's someone who's just like, unequivocally, she was great. She's fantastic. And I think especially, you know, maybe women who obviously Thatcher was the first female prime minister. So they often evoke Thatcher. And I think that's partly why Rachel Reeves does this as well. It's like, you know, this was a great woman. I can be a great woman too. I will be a great woman too for the Labour Party. So a lot of it is that. And I think ultimately the Labour Party are happy to kind of fight election on these terms. They're happy to shift to the right. They think it's what's going to win them the election in terms of you need to appeal to this particular type of voter. What's annoying is not everyone's going to like this rhetoric. And I think Labour needs to realise that you don't have to appeal to this particular segment of the population by adopting this rhetoric. There are other voters who'd be quite amenable to a very progressive rhetoric on the economy. You don't have to shift to the right in this way that the Labour Party have done. So I find it frustrating. And I think evoking Thatcher in this way is deliberate because Starmer did it at the back end of last year. I think he spoke about how she brought great change to this country. So this is where Labour have chosen to fight this election. They've chosen to fight this election on the terms of the Conservative Party, the idea that we need to shift to the right, we need to please a particular segment of the population, we need to also please, as you mentioned, Aaron, the idea of the press. We need to make sure that we're keeping the press on side. This is the game we've chosen to play. And again, it goes back to Ash's argument. You never change the terms of a debate when you adopt your opponent's frames. There needs to be a point where Labour push back against the Conservative frames, the idea that Thatcher was great for the economy, all of these things that have become common parlance in our politics. Labour at some point need to push against this. Otherwise, what's the point? Are we saying that we can only win elections by shifting to the right economically, by shifting to the right on immigration, by shifting to the right on all these big issues? We're losing fights. This period in between elections, what should be happening is we build a consensus for our ideas. These ideas that we hold dear, these ideas that we hold sacrosanct, we build a consensus for these ideas. What's happening now is we're shifting to the right, we're adopting Conservative frames. And long term, you might win the election. You probably will. In fact, they will win the election. But long term, what happens is the debate is continually fought on the terms of the Conservative Party. And that's no good thing.
Yeah, there's a part of me which thinks basically the entire political class, including people like Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, they're fine with the post-1979 settlement, which is ironic given this was apparently, you know, this speech is about we are going to oversee the kinds of changes you saw after the end of the 1970s. I mean, I find it bizarre that Labour Party, on the precipice of coming to power, is saying that we will be like the Tory Party, just as they came into power and they governed for 18 years. That was not a good time for the country. It was a good time for certain people. Some people benefited from Thatcherism, and that's why she kept winning, you know, right to buy. And of course, you have a bunch of other policies too. Many people won out from that, privatizations. People got very cheap, you know, equity in companies that made them wealthier. You have, of course, North Sea Oil. But in terms of the long-term interests of this country, she made a hell of a lot of mistakes, and she made this country so much weaker, so much poorer, so much more divided. And if you care about regional inequality, which is one of the things I've become so radicalized about in the last 10 years, really, if you care about regional inequality and the extent to which, if you're outside the M25, if you're outside the southeast of England, you do not matter. If you care about that, you cannot at the same time say that Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s was responsible for national renewal. Because she wasn't. The word here is national, by the way. It was basically screw the rest of the country, services in the southeast of England. That's our growth model. And I was in Norway last week. If only we had a sovereign wealth fund with our North Sea oil and did what they had done. We didn't. Probably the single worst mistake made by any prime minister in the last 100 years that isn't related to foreign policy. And yet you have people like Darren Jones overtly lionizing that idiocy. I mean, the mind boggles at what point this is going to stop. Following media coverage ahead of tonight's speech, a spokesperson for Rachel Reeves got in touch with The Guardian and said that in the extracts from her lecture released overnight, that's last night, she is not saying that Margaret Thatcher ushered in a, quote, decade of renewal. Here again, then, for the benefit of our audience, is the quote in full. I remain an optimist about our ability to rise the challenges we face. If we can bring together public and private sectors in a national mission directed at restoring strong economic growth across Britain. When we speak of a decade of national renewal, that is what we mean. As we did at the end of the 1970s, okay, we stand at an inflection point. And as in earlier decades, the solution lies in wide-ranging supply-side reform to drive investments, remove the blockages, constraining our productive capacity, and fashion a new economic settlement drawing on evolutions in economic thought, a new chapter in Britain's economic history. And unlike the 1980s, growth in the years to come must be broad-based, inclusive, and resilient. The spokesperson accepts that when Reeves talks about supply-side reforms, offering the solution as in earlier decades, she is referring to the 1980s, but Reeves is not endorsing the whole Thatcher experience. That goes to my point at the top of this. She's wrong about the growth bit. There was no liftoff from 1979. The economy got smaller by 5.9%. Unemployment doubled in the first 2 years of the Thatcher government. If Labour do that, there will be rioting on the streets. I wouldn't want you to try and imitate that because the situation would be politically unmanageable. Now, sticking with Labour for a moment, I could not ignore this story, particularly because you'll hear very little of it elsewhere. The Metropolitan Police Service, get this is remarkable, have confirmed they've launched an investigation into an internal selection process for a political party in Croydon that took place late last year. Now, they've not said who that is, but we know, simply by inference, that it relates to Labour's selection process for the constituency of Croydon East in South London. And Scotland Yard's cybercrime team are investigating alleged, quote, computer misuse. The contest was temporarily halted last November, with a party investigation revealing that personal details of some members had been, quote, altered on the Labour Party membership database without authorisation. Now, this is what matters. Was that to let non-members vote, or was it to stop certain members from voting the wrong way? The answer to those questions will come out in the process of this now criminal investigation, one hopes, but the website Inside Croydon hints at the motivations at work. They write this. On one list, 71 members had their home address changed compared to a list from earlier in 2023. 26 had their phone number changed. 40 members had been given new email addresses, potentially very handy when it comes to remote voting in a tightly contested selection. It's pretty obvious what's happening there. You identify the people most likely to vote for somebody in those selections and you change their contact details. Andrew Fisher, a member in the constituency relevant here in Croydon, and former head of policy for Jeremy Corbyn, said this in response. Members are being really let down by some seemingly terrible behaviour, .. This from my own local party. Seemingly terrible behaviour, seemingly, potentially, criminal activity. I mean, that's why the Met are involved. By pure coincidence, Unison official Joel Bodmer announced last week he would be quitting the race to become Labour's candidate for the constituency. I'm sure this is all entirely unrelated. London Labour was approached for comment by Labour List, but unsurprisingly, a source said the party was unable to comment, given this was now an ongoing police investigation. I have to say, this is a live investigation into a potentially rigged election by the Metropolitan Police Service. and I've not heard a peep on LBC or Newsnight. There's no Panorama investigation. This is absolutely incredible. We're looking at a party which will form the next party of government, the Labour Party. We're looking at the constituency or the area, Croydon, which is really where David Evans, the now party general secretary, had his stomping ground. Key allies of Starmer represent that constituency and the constituencies around it, Steve Reid being one. And yet nobody is joining the dots. You think that these people could oversee fair and free elections at a national level when they're allegedly fixing and messing around with data at the local level. Well, if you believe that, you're more than welcome. I would be very, very concerned if this person was found to be guilty, or people were found to be guilty, and people that worked with them, alongside them, are somehow responsible for administering the British state. I think that's a big concern. But I don't think we're going to see any LBC call-ins, any James O'Brien aneurysms anytime soon. Ask yourself why. Next story. On Monday, the EU's top foreign policy official accused Israel of using hunger as a weapon of war against Palestinians in Gaza. It was one of the strongest condemnations yet by a Western leader of Israel's brutal siege of Gaza. But while some European leaders have slowly begun to voice serious concerns over what's going on in the Strip, the US has been particularly slow to sound the alarm. That's despite nearly 6 months of mounting evidence of war crimes being committed against the Palestinians. But something seems to be finally shifting. Speaking in the Philippines, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said this.
100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food insecurity. That's the first time an entire population has been so classified. We also see, again, according to, in this case, the United Nations, 100%, the totality of the population, is in need of humanitarian assistance. Compare that to Sudan, about 80% of the population there is in need of humanitarian assistance. Afghanistan, about 70%. So, again, this only underscores both the urgency, the imperative of making this the priority.
Of course, Blinken doesn't explicitly mention Israel there, but his stark description of the impending famine in Gaza marks a subtle shift in emphasis. And the space slowly opening up between European and American positions was made even clearer when Ireland's Taoiseach Leo Varadkar attended St. Patrick's Day celebrations at the White House alongside President Joe Biden. As we know, Joe Biden has a very close affinity with Ireland. He frequently mentions his own Irish heritage. And as a senator, he helped push Bill Clinton into providing resources for negotiations that led to the Good Friday Agreement. Varadkar took the opportunity to draw a connection between Biden's love of Ireland and the brutal situation in Gaza. He began with this reminder.
This week, meeting so many proud Irish Americans, I've been thinking a lot about sacred promises. And I've been thinking in particular of the words of one courageous Irish American, a lawyer and a decorated war hero, who spoke so eloquently about the sacred promises that we make as leaders. To quote his words, it's about the promises we make to our children who deserve a chance to succeed, the promises we make to each other, the sacred promise to work for a better future for all. Those were the words of Beau Biden.
Beau Biden was Joe Biden's son who died of brain cancer in 2015. The president was visibly moved by him being mentioned. Varadkar then went on to say this.
Mr. President, as you know, the Irish people are deeply troubled about the catastrophe that's unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. And when I travel the world, leaders often ask me why the Irish have such empathy for the Palestinian people. And the answer is simple. We see our history in their eyes, a story of displacement, of dispossession, a national identity questioned and denied, forced emigration, discrimination, and now hunger. So we support your work and that of your administration to secure a humanitarian ceasefire and to create the space for lasting peace. The people of Gaza desperately need food, medicine, and shelter, And most especially, they need the bombs to stop.
Now, I read that as a swipe at Biden, actually, because he's talking there about the things they need, aid, shelter, and so on. They need, more than anything else, the bombs to stop. Now, of course, the United States is giving a huge aid package to Israel, about $19 billion, presently going through the House, precisely so they can continue this war on Gaza, this war on effectively children. Average age in the Gaza Strip is 18. I think half the population in Gaza is younger than 18, rather. A very young average age. And he's saying, really, that the most important thing is to stop the violence. Now, of course, that's not something that Biden has done. He's actually stopped short of saying that. Mike, what's your read here? They were very conciliatory and, I thought, fine words from Leah Varadkar. Very clever politics, to also mention Joe Biden's son. And also very clever to draw attention to the similarities, really, between the dispossession, the displacement of the Irish people, particularly in the mid-19th century and, of course, after the Great Famine, and what's going on in Gaza. I mean, that should be the kind of story, the kind of narrative that doesn't just pull on the heartstrings of Joe Biden, but actually Irish Americans right across the United States.
Absolutely. I think it's a really, really powerful contribution and really powerful way in which he delivered it. I think the reason why it's so powerful, there are two things, right? He draws the parallels between Ireland and the Palestinian people and the suffering, you know, both groups have experienced because of displacements. And really, really powerful in that parallel. Then crucially, he evokes Joe Biden's son. I mean, I know Joe Biden, when it comes to his son, is understandably gets very, very emotional whenever his son is mentioned and or is evoked. And I think that's really, really powerful because it's in many ways, you know, what people are asking for when it comes to Gaza isn't particularly radical. You know, we're calling for an end to suffering. We're calling for a ceasefire. And when it comes to a ceasefire, for me, a ceasefire is just the start. You know, thinking about things like boycotts and other things that are much bigger demands. The ceasefire is just the start of our demands. So I think it is really, really important, you know, that we see a ceasefire as something that's very, very important. And I think people are beginning to get to that point. People are beginning to realize that, hey, listen, we need to stop this. This is not okay. I mean, it's taken people long enough, but people have got there. And I think hopefully as that kind of becomes the consensus, we can then move to kind of more radical demands and demands that actually do really, you know, shake things and you know, make people feel very, very uncomfortable, because that's what's needed in this situation. So I thought it was a really compelling bit of politics. And I think it's really important that we are having leaders now. I've spoken a lot, and I've been on Navarra, this kind of liberal consensus, which does still, it is still a thing. And there is still this liberal consensus of, well, you know, Israel has the right to defend itself. That is still a thing. And some people are still saying that. But it's good that we're having some really, really powerful, compelling stories and powerful, compelling voices like Varadkar there, and the way in which she told that story was fantastic. I think it's important we have more and more of those voices, especially speaking to people like Biden and to the US, because they have a really important role to play in this. And they, in many ways, can really, really change and shift things, right? So it's important we continue to say these things, because it is important. And a ceasefire is just the start of the changes we need to see.
Yeah, and quickly going back to Antony Blinken's comments at the top there, you know, he's saying that the entirety of Gaza is facing famine, effectively. He didn't use that word, but food deprivation is the sort of technical term, isn't it? And you've got this strange situation now where there are some people, Zionists, pro-Israel sort of voices, who say that there's nobody facing famine in Gaza, nobody's going without food. This is complete nonsense. It's fake news coming from the left. So let's go through the people saying this is the case. The EU, I think Joseph Borrell, I think last week, said that you had significant numbers of people facing famine. You've had UN agencies say it. You've had Christian Aid say it. And now you've got Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying it. But apparently this is a left-wing talking point. At a certain stage, you would hope that the people saying that kind of stuff are grasped what they are, which is fanatics who will in no way amend what they think on the basis of evidence. Let's go to your comments. This is a good one. This is a good one. And I will let you respond, Mike. Lirianne with £9.99. I don't agree with the suggestion that more women feel more sympathetic to Thatcher due to their gender. Statistically, more men vote Conservative than women, although that's getting worse, actually, since I think more women voted Tory than men in the 1980s. But park that. statistically more women, men vote Conservative. Women, that's certainly true now. Get Ash, Dahlia or Moya's take on this. Mike, how do you respond?
So I didn't say they feel sympathetic, but I feel they feel the need to evoke her because she was the first female prime minister. And then she served for such a long time in office, right? So she's seen as a success story. So that's why I think people on the left as well, like Labour politicians in the past have said, Thatcher was a great politician. I didn't agree with her politics, but, you know, she was a great woman. That is a thing that is said because she served for so long and she is seen as a kind of like, a, in inverted commas, a great prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to be corrected on this, but I'm pretty sure from 79 all the way through to 97, maybe even beyond that, I'm pretty sure women were more likely to vote Tory than men. That's changed. It's a recent, it's quite a recent phenomenon. Actually, it's, you know, it's becoming more intense over time, this kind of divergence in terms of gender patterns for voting. That doesn't mean all women liked Thatcher in the 1980s. I have to say, my mum was a Tory voter. Strange, right? She thought Thatcher was really good. And actually, sticking on Thatcher for one moment, you know, lots of people would say, well, the unions were so powerful, something had to be done. I mean, even if you think that, I don't think that. Even if you think that, maybe that something didn't have to be engineering a recession, doubling unemployment, wasting North Sea oil, privatizing everything, selling off the family silver. Maybe you didn't have to do that. You know, it's possible to say something should have been done, but actually what then followed was a complete catastrophe. I don't think that, but I think that's a, I think that's a sensible position to have, far more sensible than supporting, I think, actually, the most destructive prime minister this country's had since the Second World War. This is our next story. The BBC has issued an apology for calling Richard Tice's Reform UK a far-right party. In a statement, the corporation said this. In an article about the Liberal Democrats' spring conference, we wrongly described the political party Reform UK as far-right when referring to polling. This sentence was subsequently removed from the article as it fell short of our usual editorial standards. While the original wording was based on news agency copy, we take full responsibility and apologise for the error. It might surprise you that Reform, a party that shouts free speech at every opportunity, would be so sensitive, dare I say, offended. And given Reform's stance on immigration, culture war issues and climate change, you might also be surprised that the BBC buckled so quickly to have its language policed. On GB News, Richard Tice gave his side of the story.
There are very significant implications of calling a political party, and by implication, its leader and senior leadership team, far right. And it is that which is defamatory and libelous. That's why they've apologised immediately, and they will change their editorial guidelines. Because if they can get away with that, then all of a sudden, everybody else does. They will take that as a sort of sign of credibility. And it has huge implications. That would mean, for example, we might lose our bank accounts, we might lose the ability to get a mortgage, bank loans for our businesses. All of this flows immediately from that description.
Now, first things first, I think debanking is wrong. I said that when Farage was being, I think, mistreated by the NatWest group. You should not be debanked because of your political views. I say that as somebody who believes in freedom, and I say that as someone on the left. Today, Nigel Farage, tomorrow, me. So I can dress that up as a principled position, which I think it is, but it's also something that is very relevant to the left. Sometimes society is wrong about something, radical views come along, they change them, and the radicals who were radical, decades later, it turns out, were the ones speaking common sense. That's how we get progress. And that's why I don't think we should punish people who dissent with the prevailing views of the time. But here's the thing. If you call me far left, I don't care. Go ahead. After all, I'm clearly to the left of the Labour Party leadership, and I'm clearly to the left of many people who consider themselves centre-left. Now, personally, I view many of my opinions, like public ownership of rail, mail and water, as centre-left, and I view the people who think they're centre-left but disagree with that as actually liberals. But like I say, if you think I'm far-left, so be it. I believe in free speech. I thought Richard Tice does as well, but apparently not. What is more, I doubt that the BBC apologised because the claim is libelous or defamatory. After all, truth is a complete defence against a libel suit. And an academic specialising in defamation law, got in touch with The Guardian to say this. Richard Tice's assertion that labelling Reform UK far right is defamatory, and in particular his threat to involve lawyers against those repeating the statement, has no basis in law. Under English and Welsh defamation law, political parties have no standing to bring claims for libel or slander. Labelling particular individuals as far right can, by contrast, give rise to actionable defamation claims in principle. However, if they have themselves made statements publicly that might be interpreted as far right, they have essentially brought that view upon themselves, and therefore the statement they are now complaining about has not caused them, quote, serious harm within the meaning of Section 1 of the Defamation Act 2013. And if Tice really does think that using the term far right is libelous, maybe he'd better have a word with his only MP, recent Tory defector Lee Anderson. In February last year, he wrote this about Labour MP Kim Johnson. Shocking and disgusting comments. The far left of Labour making vile comments in the chamber today. These people want to govern our country. We must fight this every step of the way. So Reform UK isn't far right, and if you say that in the media, you're going to get a lawyer's letter. But Keir Starmer's Labour Party is far left. Really? Mike, what is good for the goose is good for the gander. Why are reforms so triggered about being called far right when their only MP thinks that the Labour Party is on the far left?
I think they're triggered because they know that labels matter, and being framed as a far right party does in some ways delegitimise them and frames them in extreme exactors. Now, I think it's really important we frame Reform UK as a far right party rather than a populist party, because what often happens is these parties that espouse really far-right rhetoric are being framed in the media as populist. And what this does is it suggests that they're talking for the people. And what it suggests is that they're talking for some kind of democratic demands that people have, these legitimate concerns that people have. So it's important to label them as what they are. And in most academic circles, as someone who's an academic, the far-right, you know, and Reform UK, the Reform UK share many parallels to a kind of traditional far-right party. So think about one of their kind of hallmark policies. And one of the things that, if you think about Reform UK, you think about this particular thing, mass immigration. Now, what most far-right parties say is their nation, whether it's France or the UK, whichever nation the far-right party's from, they say that mass immigration represents an existential threat. Now, what Reform UK do is they suggest the same thing, right? And they've spoken a lot about Islam being a threat to the UK, you know, Muslims being a threat to the UK. You know, Lee Anderson, in his speech he gave when he became a Reform UK MP, I urge our viewers to listen back to that speech and learn, urge whoever's listening to this as a podcast, listen back to what Lee Anderson says. It is, and I played it to some of my students last week, it is very powerful. Some of the things he says about we need to get our country back. People are coming here, essentially an alien culture is what he's suggesting. These people who are coming here aren't integrating. This is all far-right rhetoric. This is all the rhetoric we heard from Unit Powell in the 1960s. So the fact that being labelled as a far-right party isn't just because people want to label them as such. It's because they are a far-right party. And I think it's important to use that framing rather than what often happens is they're a populist party. They are not a populist party. This is a far-right party, and it's important that labels attached to them no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, Richard Tice labels Reform UK. Reform UK labels itself, rather, as we examined a moment ago, it's important to delimit political parties from people. It's literally impossible to slander a political party as far right or to libel a political party as far right. They say that they're net zero on migration, and they want a complete end to any immigration unless it's for essential migrant workers. And I don't quite, I mean, look, essential migrant workers is a very tenuous term. It could be 20,000 a year, it could be 320,000 a year. Essential is a very strange term. What it means is, though, what's not essential is that if you're a British person, you fall in love with somebody from overseas, is it essential that that person is able to live here with you and you can make a life together? Not really. So they oppose that. And that's a lot of people, by the way. It happens a lot. The Tories are bringing the cap in terms of you have to earn a certain amount to be able to have a spouse over here in the UK. I think in January 2025, that's going up to £38,500 a year. If you earn less than that, you're simply not allowed to fall in love with somebody from abroad and make a life in the UK. There's a cost on that. Reform UK would go further. They'd ban that altogether. They'd stop it altogether. I don't see how that's not a far-right policy. you might agree with that policy, but it's a far-right policy. There might be some people watching or listening go, well, I think that's a good policy. It's a far-right policy. It's to the right of any centre-right political party in Europe or North America. So, I think on the one hand, it's very strange for them to repeatedly attack the Conservative Party as liberals, a liberal party, and yet they get upset when they are labelled as a far-right party. You know, if you're to the right of the Conservatives and Labour's on the far left, I mean, where do you think you are? You know, this is kind of basic positioning. But look, I won't denigrate Mr. Tice. I'll respectfully disagree. I don't want to get a lawyer's letter. Although on this count, I don't think that would have gone very far. That just seems like essentially an act of very low-level intimidation of the media. Because like you say, I think really that label of far-right hurts. So of course you adopt far-right policies and far-right rhetoric, but then you say, look, we're centrists, we're liberals. Even though the centre of this country wants public ownership of things like rail, mail and water. And Reform UK certainly do not. Mike, thanks for joining me this evening.
Always a pleasure, Aaron.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. That went really quick. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream. You've been watching Novara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.